Right. Well, thanks for the chance to be here. It's awesome to be in Santa Barbara. All right, yeah, so today I'm going to try to tell you about some work that I've been doing recently with Kyle Aitken, Eric Pappas, and Larry Appy. Larry's actually here somewhere in the audience. So before I start, I want to immediately apologize. I am not, in fact, going to be talking about QCD on a small circle. So I would love to be able to talk about QCD on a small circle, but I don't really have time. I'm going to focus on Puri and Mills theory. And even for Puri and Mills theory, it's going to be a bit deformed. Okay, I'm going to have to put it in a circle, but I hope it's still tasty, even though it's not, you know, what we might all want to immediately do, which is 40 Yang-Mills theory without any caveats. Okay, so that's the real title. Okay, so we're all here, or at least many of us are here, because we believe that quantum field theory observables are some kind of resurgent trend series in some kind of couplings. So schematically, they look something like that, where lambda is the coupling. There might be more than one coupling, of course. Now, why do we believe that? We have lots of kind of intuition, but really, the reason we believe it is we have lots of evidence from direct computations in many special cases, ranging from integrals with saddles, finite dimensional integrals, I mean, to matrix models, which are some other finite dimensional things, to topological strings, to quantum mechanics, some supersymmetric field theories, and people in the audience have worked on all of this stuff. But then you could ask, why would we expect anything like this in realistic quantum field theories with asymptotic freedom, like Yang-Mills theory or like QCD, or for that matter, for two-dimensional field theories with asymptotic freedom? Because there it's much harder to make any precise statement. And part of the immediate challenge, for which, of course, there are many possible responses, but one of the immediate challenges is, what in the world do you even mean by lambda when we write such a trend series? That's not obvious in asymptotically free theory. Because, of course, lambda runs, the Tooth coupling runs, so you have to figure out what do you mean by the coupling before you can write this down. And then a second question is, what kind of trend series should you expect? So the one I showed you is built out of powers of the coupling, maybe one over the coupling, some logs of the coupling. Actually, I didn't even show the logs, but they're generally there in pretty much all interesting examples, and exponentials of one over the coupling. And I'm going to argue today that in QCD, in particular in Yang-Mills theory, I should say in Yang-Mills theory, we also need iterated exponentials, at least. You can just see those appearing. And so I'm going to give an argument for this, but I should say before I begin that the appearance of such things was anticipated in a poorly appreciated paper, I think, by Misha Schiffman very early on, around 1994. Okay, I would love to understand the connections between what we're finding and what was proposed by Misha. I don't understand them yet, but I'm sure that there must be some connection. So, okay. So here's an outline of my talk. So first I'm going to talk about how to think about doing a semi-classical expansion for an asymptotically free field theory. The challenge, of course, is that the coupling runs, the interesting observables are low energy ones, and then the relevant coupling isn't small, so it's very hard to actually say something concrete. So I'm going to explain an approach that lets one do that. And we're going to see some differences from standard quantum mechanics and quantum field theory examples. And so you want some kind of semi-classical expansion that is actually useful. And by that I mean that the first few orders in this expansion are a good guide to the physical properties. So yeah, I'll explain the currently best understood approach to this that I know of, and then I'll highlight some of its physical and especially mathematical lessons in the case of Puri and Mills theory. So to motivate this, the approach I'm going to take, let's think about what we would want if we're trying to set up some kind of semi-classical useful expansion. So you want the coupling to be small at long distances, because if it's not, then you can't do semi-classics, at least not for long-distance observables. And if you try to do this, well, you should do it in such a way that you keep as many features of QCD as possible, as many of the key features. And those key features, from my point of view, are things like asymptotic freedom, quark confinement, chiral symmetry breaking, Lorentz invariance, and the lack of any macroscopic scalar fields, because QCD certainly doesn't have them, and if you add them, the theory really, really changes in dramatic ways. I think there is no approach that really keeps all of this, at least not that I know of. You have to sacrifice something. So what I'm going to choose to sacrifice is this thing. I'm going to sacrifice manifest Lorentz invariance. in a way that I'll explain in a second. Now, for people who do supersymmetry, the one they sacrifice is this one. And the reason this is helpful is if you have scalar fields, then you can use them to get yourself a Higgs mechanism and get to weak coupling through the Higgs mechanism. That's great, but we don't have scalar fields in QCD, so the question is, what do you do? Okay, so turns out pushing this thing essentially lets you follow the same path without introducing any microscopic scalars. So the suggestion, originally made by Mithat, Larry Yaffe, and Nika Schiffman, in papers starting from around 2008, is to break 4D Lorentz invariance in studying these kinds of theories, but as little as possible. So you compactify on one circle. You start in a four-dimensional theory, compactify on one circle. The idea, very roughly, is that if the circle is very small, then if you can also show that the coupling at the scale of the circle size is what's relevant for long-distance physics, which is not obvious, you have to show that, but if you can show it, then by standard asymptotic freedom arguments, if L is very small compared to the strong scale, the coupling becomes weak at long distances. And then you're in business, then you can do semi-classics. Now, I want to comment on a couple of features of this. When we do this, we still have Lorentz invariance in three directions. They are non-compact. And three is bigger than two. And this is a good thing, because if you have three non-compact directions, symmetries can still break spontaneously. And this is a feature and not a bug, because you know, real QCD has a diverse pattern of symmetry realizations. Some symmetries are spontaneously broken, others are not. And you want to be able to capture that. So you need three non-compact directions to avoid the Kohn-Memmer-Wagner theorem at finite n. So this is a nice setup from this point of view. Okay, and if you do this kind of semi-classical analysis, for it to be useful, you better be working in the same phase at weak coupling as you would be at strong coupling, because otherwise it'll be a very complicated and difficult to follow relationship between your results and whatever you actually wanted to understand. Okay, so you want to have the same pattern of symmetry realization. Now, why would this help? Why would it help to compactify a theory in a circle, really? The reason, more or less, is the following. When you compactify a Yang-Mills theory in a circle, the Polyakov loop becomes an observable. That is, the holonomy of the gauge field wrapped in the circle. More precisely, its traces become observables. And the gauge invariant data in the Polyakov loop, written here, are just its eigenvalues. Now, the eigenvalues of a Polyakov loop, classically, have a moduli space. That is to say, classically, if you look at the classical action of the theory, you can choose anything for these eigenvalues and it's okay. It's a solution to the equations of motion. It doesn't cost you any energy. But then you think about this. Imagine a circle is small and you work in some kind of three-dimensional effective field theory living here. That's some Yang-Mills theory coupled to an adjoint scalar, which is really this A3 gauge field. It's part of your theory in the first place. And if these eigenvalues are non-trivial, then that means A3, roughly speaking, in the usual perturbative bad language, has a BEV. And that means that there is, again, in the same usual bad language, SUN breaks to U1 to the N minus 1, in general, if these are not coincident. So A3 acts like a compact adjoint Higgs field. This is nice, but we can't quite just go with this, right? Because the theory picks its own vacuum. This is not our choice. At the quantum level. Classically, it is our choice, quantum mechanically, it isn't. Now, one other thing. When you're at very large circle sizes, you can ask, what is the distribution of these eigenvalues? What does the theory actually choose? And the answer is that it chooses a distribution, if we're talking about pure Yang-Mills theory, where the trace of the holonomy is zero. And moreover, the trace of powers of the holonomy is also zero until you get to n powers of the holonomy. And that is supposed to be related to the fact that center symmetry is not broken when the circle is very large. On the other hand, you can take pure Yang-Mills theory and go to small circle sizes and ask, what does it do? And this was done by Gross, Pisarsky, and Yaffe quite a number of years ago. And the answer is that the trace of the holonomy is not zero at small circle sizes. That is to say, the gauge field in the compact direction is zero. Okay, the BEV of the gauge field in the compact direction is effectively zero. So for the idea that I'm saying, that I was advocating, this is a disaster. Okay? So that means that at small circle sizes, you're in a center symmetry broken phase, you're not confined, whatever you compute will be related in some very complicated way, if at all, to what happens at large sample sizes. So this is not good. Of course, people recognize this very early on. So the question is, how do you proceed? And the idea proposed in these papers is to take your Yang-Mills theory, or more generally some other 4D confining quantum field theory, and add something to it that leaves the large L theory basically the same, but makes the small L limit smooth, at least as far as you can tell by checking all known order parameters. Proving it is hard. Okay. So there are basically two options that I know of on the market for dealing with this. Okay. So, and either one of them works for the purposes of this talk. I don't care which one. So one of them is to take Yang-Mills theory and add to it, for instance, one Dirac Adrian fermion with periodic boundary conditions and some mass, which is, you know, not zero, but not too big. In particular, it should be bounded by the size of the circle, okay, when the circle is small. Or if you don't want to change the matter content, you can do something that sounds challenging, but is in fact quite sensible. You can add certain appropriate double trace deformations to the theory, which basically give the same effect as these Adrian fermions. What happens when you do this is that the dynamics of the theory at small circle sizes is altered in such a way that in fact it's the confining vacuum which is chosen. The confining distribution of eigenvalues, where they're evenly spread out, is the one that actually wins. Okay? Both of these things don't do anything to the large volume behavior of the theory. Well, at least this one does not. This one is more subtle, but if the fermions are relatively heavy, then you would hope that, you know, you're okay. Okay. So that's those are two options. Suppose you pick one. Okay, then you ask, what is the effect on the low energy behavior when the circle is small? Let's see how far we can get. Well, both theories are centrosymmetric, as I've been saying, essentially by construction. And by construction, again, the non-coincident eigenvalues of the holonomy lead to a breaking of the gauge group from SUN to U1 to the n minus 1. So there's an Adron Higgs mechanism. That means that if, you know, there's some doubly bosons, and you have to compute their mass, and their mass looks like this. This is quantizing units of 2 pi over NL. Why am I saying this? The reason I'm saying this is you need to argue that at long distances the theory is weakly coupled. I haven't done that yet. I've just said it's in the right phase. The point is that, you know, at very short distances, the coupling flow is as it always is. It has to be. It flows to weak coupling. But now imagine going to longer distances. And let's suppose the doubly boson mass scale is large compared to lambda QCD. Then when you go past the doubly boson mass scale, right, you have a theory which is U1 to the N minus 1 gauge theory coupled to heavy matter, but the matter is at this scale. You go down here, there's no more matter. Coupling stops running at this scale. So there you go, at weak coupling, you are controllably in the weakly coupled regime, and you can do computations, honestly. Okay. If you had put this scale here, you would have had this kind of flow. That's very interesting, but I don't want to talk about it. Okay, so as I keep saying, you get this pattern of symmetry breaking. So at long distances, it looks like we're just taking Yang-Mills theory and produced some kind of U1 to the NS1, QED in three dimensions. Now, I'm going to ignore the doubly bosons. Actually, they have some very interesting physics, but again, in interest of time, maybe I shouldn't talk about it. And also, they're heavy. So let me focus on the very lightest degrees of freedom, which are the degrees of freedom that describe this gauge group. Okay? They're the Cartan gluons of the original gauge group. So if you think of these things as Cartan gluons, what that really means is that if you write all of your gauge field variables as matrices, they're the things that live in diagonals. So that description makes it sound like these things are very gauge-dependent objects that you've just, how shall I say this? That you can label each one of them with a color that doesn't sound gauge-invariant. That's what I really mean by that. But actually, they, of course, contain very much gauge-invariant physical information. And the way to see that, one of the ways to see that, is actually to note that as an interpolating operator, the field strengths associated with these U1 factors actually have very nice gauge invariant representations built using the holonomy with some Fourier sums out of the original 4D gauge field. Okay.
But it's clear that the Higgs phase people Yeah. Well, you say that it's a breaking of the gauge theory.
That's right, but
it's a Higgs realization.
Of course, of course, of course, of course. So this had to be true. This definitely had to be true. The only reason I'm emphasizing this is that understanding exactly how to think about these things in a gauge invariant looking way is going to be helpful for me to identify which 4D operators are giving me this. It had to be true that somebody does.
Yeah.
It would be harder. Yeah.
Possible.
That's right. I'm sure. Exactly. I don't mean that this is at all deep. But the particular expression is going to be really important for me. So I'll come back to it. So suppose you want to describe what is long distance physics here. Okay. Well, I said a 3D QED, but let's dig into that. To actually understand what happens at long distances, it's very helpful to use 3D abelian duality to trade the field strengths for the U1 gauge fields for their scalar partners. So there's a duality transformation that you can do to do that. And the result is that the long distance theory looks like basically n scalar fields, like this. Now, you look at this effective theory, this is what happens at tree level. And at tree level, there's clearly a shift symmetry here. And in fact, you can show that this shift symmetry amounts to the conservation of magnetic charge, the absence of magnetic charges in the theory. But in fact, you know, that means that this shift symmetry persists to all orders in perturbation theory, because there are no magnetic monopoles in perturbation theory and Yang-Mills theory. So these fields will be massless to all orders in perturbation theory. But non-perturbatively, it's much more interesting, because we're dealing with compact QED, if you want. So of course there are magnetic monopoles. In particular, since the gauge group symmetry breaking pattern is like this, one can show that the 4D instanton actually breaks up into n monopole instantons, which are perfectly well-defined field configurations by themselves. Each of them has an action which is 1/n of the instanton action. So if we would take a large n limit, which I won't in this talk, they would survive the large n limit. And you know, n minus 1 of these things have topological charge 1 over n, and some magnetic charges are plus and minus 1 under the nearest neighbor U1s. And then there's an extra one, which is called the Kaluza-Klein monopole, which can be traced to the fact that we're working with a microscopically four-dimensional quantum field theory, not a microscopically three-dimensional quantum field theory. And this guy's actually quite important for the physics. Anyway, since these things have magnetic charge, they generate interactions for the dual photons, or dual gluons, whatever, which break the shift symmetries, and therefore will generate masses. So in particular, the Tuft amplitudes associated to these magnetic monopoles look something like this. And at this point, I just want to emphasize that these monopole instantons, unlike normal instantons, they have a well-defined core size. They do not have a scale modulus. And their typical separation, when the circle is small and the coupling is weak, is like this. And notice that a typical separation is much larger than their size. So that means that if you want to compute the effect of these objects on long distance physics, you can do this honestly by doing a dilute instanton gas type sum without selling your soul, okay? Which is what you have to do to think about instantons in four-dimensional Yang-Mills theory without microscopic scalar fields, right? That has well-known infrared disasters that I don't think have a known systematic resolution, at least to me. Okay, so that can be done. Polyakov taught us how to do such things, maybe others as well. And so we can work out what is the potential for the dual photons. And to leading order in semiclassics, here's what it is. Of course, there are corrections, but they won't be important for what I'm saying. So you get some cosine. And of course, a cosine, if you expand it out, is a quadratic term. So shut up and diagonalize, and you get a mass spectrum. And here's the mass spectrum. So let me stop and take stock. What we just found is we take Yang-Mills theory, put it in a circle, make the circle small while making sure that center symmetry doesn't break, and what we found is that the theory manufactures for itself a non-perturbative mass gap. Okay? It's non-perturbative and it's a gap. There are no gapless degrees of freedom in the theory. This is just as we would expect, and this is a concrete realization of the old dream by various famous people that the mass gap should be driven by more or less the condensation of magnetic monopoles. It's different in the details. Nothing is actually condensing. These are pseudoparticles, they're not particles. But it's more or less right. Also, I should say, you can compute the string tension associated with this stuff. And it's finite, which it better have been, because we're claiming there's confinement here. So that actually happens, you can do it. And it behaves just as expected from Yang-Yole's theory. And in particular, its behavior is much closer in sharp ways to Yang-Yole's theory than what you would have gotten from Cyber-Witten theory with n greater than 2. I'm happy to talk about this point later with people who know about Cyber-Witten theory, if you don't believe me. But let me move on past that. Oops, sorry. So then you can ask, can we celebrate? Are the sigmas glue balls? Right? Ideally, that should be, you know, what we just found. And the answer is no. Because remember, I have this mass formula and there's some weird integer in it, p. Okay? Now what is p? Well, if you track through where all this came from, you discover that this p is in fact that p. Now, who cares? Well, so the thing is, the holonomy, or traces of the holonomy, transform under center symmetry. So tracking through, you discover that the pth mass eigenstate, built out of these dual photons, transforms into center symmetry by a phase. And if you ask what is this range of p's, it goes from 1 to n minus 1. So none of them are neutral. So they're all carrying center charge. That's actually bad, or at least it's not good. Because the center p charge states, you can think of as p winding states. They're associated to strings winding the compact direction. Now we're at very small l, so such states can be light. But imagine making l bigger and tracking the same state with this given quantum number. Its energy is going to blow up, right? Because we know this from string theory or any kind of thinking. Okay, so then you can ask, well, okay, so whatever we just found, they may be the lightest states in the theory, but they are not the ones that extrapolate smoothly to large L. So what are the lightest states that have the right quantum numbers to extrapolate smoothly to large L? And the answer is, it's bound states built out of the things that I'm talking about. Now, by the way, if you look at this, this may not be that implausible. See, this is only linear in F. You might think blue balls should be, you know, quadratic in F. So bound states of these things will be quadratic in F. That's very heuristically, that's what should be happening. So let's just see it. Let me take n equals 2 to be as simple as possible. Okay? Everything I'm saying is going to go through for any n. So you take your effective action, complete with the monopole generated terms, it's a cosine, and you expand it and use canonical normalization. And you get something like this. Here, m gamma is basically some non-perturbatively small mass scale, okay, given here. Epsilon is some tiny coupling, which is itself exponentially small. And the center symmetry acts by taking sigma to minus sigma. Okay, that's all that center symmetry does here. And then you look at this thing. It's a 3D effective field theory. It's relativistic. So the power counting should be the following. Well, this term is relevant. This term is marginal, and this term is irrelevant, and all the next ones are irrelevant. And then you think about it a little more, and you say, okay, well, there is a marginal term, but there's a gap, and the coupling is small. So the interactions are very weak. So you can, nothing major should happen from these interactions. One might think when you first look at this, depending on who you are and how experienced you are. And in fact, you know, the presence of these interactions, to my knowledge, is pretty much ignored in the literature. So actually, though, these interactions are important. They produce bound states. To see that, let me guess that the binding energy is going to be small compared to the rest mass. We're going to see that that's actually true. Then,
bound state of what and what?
Bound state of two dual photons.
Two sigmas.
Two sigmas.
Okay.
Yep, exactly.
And opposite charges.
With opposite charges, exactly right. There will be such things. That's exactly right. They have attractive interactions. Now, so let me say that a little bit more slowly. So to actually do this, because the way it actually happens is kind of fun. Okay, to actually do this, you need to, well, the most efficient way to do it that I know of is to use a non-relativistic expansion. And to build a non-relativistic effective field, you're describing the bound state effects. Because the binding energy is small, so I can do that. That's the right way from an effective field theory point of view to approach the problem. And if you do that, here is the effective action. Now, then you want to ask which terms are important here. And now you have to use non-relativistic power counting, which is this. And in fact, this term is marginal with respect to non-relativistic power counting, which means its coefficient runs. In fact, you can show, for instance, by computing, you know, one loop scattering amplitudes, or from mapping this into a Schrodinger problem and solving the relevant Schrodinger problem, you can show that the coefficient here actually depends on your cutoff scale logarithmically. It runs to asymptotic freedom. So you get, quote unquote, strong coupling at long distances. So I'm going to talk about the effects of this, but before I do, let me just make one comment. This may seem like a disaster, right? Because we started with strong coupling at long distances due to asymptotic freedom, and in a relativistic quantum field theory, it is a bit of a disaster for people who want to do analytic stuff. But fortunately, all of this is happening for me in a non-relativistic regime, and this saves us. You can just sum all the Feynman diagrams and get the answer. Okay? So this is not a disaster, but it's funny that it appears. We're effectively getting some kind of effective field theory onion. Okay? So we start at very short distances with 40 Yang mills, then we have a sequence of effective field theories which are certainly not asymptotically free, and then eventually when we get to really long distances, we get, again, an asymptotically free field theory. Fine. Who cares? Yes? Yes. And?
Supposed to be a bound state of two of these photons, or photons that are whose mass is going to infinity, and with small running energy.
Their mass doesn't have to go to infinity.
Previously,
the mass of individual ones would have gone to infinity if you tried to naively extrapolate. Right. But the bound state, the binding energy, will grow as you increase the circle size. And you see, by quantum numbers, the thing that is small. That's right. So of course I'm working in a regime where all of these things are, binding energies are small, I can actually do my computations. And what I'm saying is I'm about to identify, or maybe I already identified, states with the right quantum numbers to extrapolate to large L, which we haven't done quite yet, at least in the previous works on the subject, which only talked about dual photons. Once they have the right quantum numbers to extrapolate to large L, that's already some victory, because you might have wondered, are there any such things at all? But showing how they do the extrapolation, that's the Clay Prize, right, in some sense. No, we have certainly not shown how they extrapolate to large L, because that's amounts to solving the full strongly coupled field theory. And I don't know how to do that. Wish I could. So I'm running out of time. So let me just point out what's going on here. So the binding energy in this quantum mechanic example, you can think of as a strong coupling momentum squared divided by the mass scale in the problem. And if you dig through what that means and figure out what is the appropriate UV cutoff on the effective description that I'm using, doing this calculation in, you discover that the binding energy expressed in units of my effective cutoff, which is this dual photon mass scale, is an iterated exponential. Okay? And these are the things that are centroid neutral. So what that means is that the earlier belief in the previous works on the subject before our work, that the dual photon mass scale is associated with the lightest states that have a smooth extrapolation to large L, at least if you believe that things with the right quantum number should extrapolate to large L. That was correct, but kind of non-trivially so. Hiding in the discussion was an iterated exponential mass scale. So that means, for this audience, that one must include iterated exponentials in the Chern series representation of Yang-Mills theory. You cannot get away from it. So I'm out of time, so I should stop very quickly. So there exists a small L limit of QCD, Yang-Mills, where you can do computations, and it leads to interesting, at least I think, leads to interesting insights, both physically, because you get insights into confinement and things I didn't talk about, like theta dependence, Romulans, Hagedorn behavior, large N limits, and so on, and chiral symmetry breaking, and many other things. But it also leads to some mathematical insights, which is an illustration, I think fairly sharply, that you must include iterated exponential coupling dependence when thinking about the Chern series representation of gauge theory. Thank you.
Thank you very much. In principle, I have two questions, but maybe I will ask here only one question, which bothers me for 10 years already. Uh-huh. You are certainly right in saying, let's add, for instance, two adjoint fermions, then the Polyakov line is equal to zero at small L, mm-hmm. where the coupling constant is small, it is believed to vanish at large L, true from other arguments. Mm-hmm. However, from the very inception of the Polyakov, and it's the only known order parameter, mm-hmm. okay, with some reservation. But since the very inception of the Polyakov line, it was understood the way how Polyakov understood this vanishing of the Polyakov line is that the eigenvalue, this is a matrix, right?
Yeah.
So he believed that at strong coupling, at least, eigenvalues are very chaotically
yeah,
fluctuating.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And each of a single eigenvalues vanish, on average vanishes.
Absolutely, I agree.
Okay,
yes.
And they
yes.
are not correlated, so the trace also vanishes.
Very good.
Now, at smaller L, although the order parameter is still zero, but the physical picture of this zero is different because it's a highly ordered system with all eigenvalues around the circle equidistant. And therefore, it's not that a single eigenvalue oscillates
yeah.
like crazy.
Yeah, yeah,
on the
yeah.
contrary, because it's in the Higgs phase, that's weak coupling, they are nailed, but they are nailed equidistantly around the circle.
That's
when
right.
you add them together, you get zero.
That's
so.
Right.
In the absence of the other order parameter, you say, okay, there is no phase transition. And I would say so too, and I said so, but it bothers me for 10 years.
Yes.
How come completely different physical realizations do not manifest themselves in some distinction in something like some other order parameter or
yeah.
maybe more subtle?
The only invariant.
At small circle and large circle.
Yeah, but sure. Not only just the Polyakov line, but if you cannot go to large and n, but many, many different Polyakov lines in the square and the cube, they're all zero, right?
All
yeah.
zero.
No, but that's a statement that
can I make a comment? So, Misha, I think it would be absolutely fascinating to find some other order parameter, some topological order, something, in addition to what we already know in Yang-Mills theory. That would be a huge deal if we could find one. And we haven't found one yet, but it's definitely worth thinking about. So as you said, to the best of our knowledge, these things are smoothly connected, but you know, you cannot really exclude a dragon lurking somewhere in between small circles and large circles. At least I can't.
There is progress.
Okay,
to comment on Misha's question, actually Misha and I wrote a paper 10 years ago, which has in the title Smooth Journey,
yes.
referring to this phenomenon. But I think there is one more insight here, which is a new progress. Actually, we examined not only one theory here now, we examined many theories with fermionic matter. And you can look to the chiral symmetry realization, and whenever it is supposed to be smoothly connected, it is always smoothly connected.
Oh,
one looks for a deeper reason for that.
Yeah.
And I think deeper reason is coming from the recent work of Zohar, Komar, Gotsky, Nati Seiberg, and we are trying now to phrase that in a proper way. There is always a mixed anomaly between center symmetry and some others, either some continuous chiral symmetry or discrete chiral symmetry. And whenever you have such a mixed anomaly, as long as you preserve your center symmetry, the others cannot make mind of their own. They are forced. They will just behave exactly as they are supposed to behave at strong coupling. Your concern is, we couldn't take our semi-classical analysis at the small circle to the large circle. That's your concern. But This is not a concern of the anomaly. Anomaly can do this, mixed anomalies. It can go from weak coupling to the strong coupling. So this is new progress in that regard.
Okay. I wonder about, when you're talking about this kind of instanton type of, description, in terms of kind of physical spectrum, I would say that this, so-called, instanton, yeah, because if you look at all, they reflect, kind of a vertex type of existence, which would be instead of monopole in three dimension, right?
Okay.
Yeah, so in this sense, it would be their mass, which would be inversely proportional to lambda, right? It would be relatively heavy as compared with your dual gluon. And I'm trying to understand whether you can formulate, what the scenario in terms of, this spectrum itself, right? In terms of the three-dimensional spectrum, which contains these vertices in particular, which are instead of monopole, instead of instanton in this sense.
So isn't that what I did?
Sorry?
Isn't that what I did? Maybe I'm misunderstanding your question.
You interpret in terms of this instanton, it was not a vertices, right?
No, I took...
Exactly.
These instanton monopoles exist, so they generate atoofed amplitudes, let's say atoofed vertices, if you want. Maybe I should have used the word vertex. And these things, when you sum over them, they exponentiate and they give you e to the I sigma plus e to the minus I sigma.
I do not see that their masses are heavy. Their masses should
be... They're pseudoparticles.
They're
pseudoparticles, first of all. They don't have a mass. That doesn't really mean anything for pseudoparticles, but their actions are like this.
The mass should be just 1 over lambda from this lowest mass, right?
The mass of the dual photon.
Yeah.
Dual photon is a physical excitation.
Yes.
It must still exponentially small, right?
Right.
And I'm talking not about photon, but about, kind of vertices. And
but look.
It cannot be exponentially small.
No.
It's not only induced vertices.
Okay.
The size is small.
The core size is NL. Oh. That's what you're. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
Their core size is is 1/MW.
Uh-huh.
It's NL. Uh-huh. So they have a definite core size. Absolutely.
I see. So, but then in this sense they are not heavy. You are saying.
I don't know what you mean by heavy. They are pseudoparticles. What do you mean by heavy?
Sure. In terms of three-dimensional C, it's a normal particle.
No, they have finite action. They don't have finite energy, they have finite action.
Right, but the instanton reflects existence of vertices.
Yes.
Like the same way as instanton in four dimensions reflects existence of monopoles, right? Yeah, because you're like Zagreb Beaton, you can explore the answer from spectrum of monopoles in dyons, right?
Well,
you do not
good.
You see, it reflects existence of multi-sigma vertices, which otherwise are not there.
It doesn't look to me as vertices. Okay, maybe I'm...
No, if you expand exponential, you will get all sorts of...
Okay, then where the mass, which would be mass of this lowest photon, divided
there's
by
the
number.
Expansion.
You do not see this. Vertices should be relatively heavy, right? Because like monopoles, their mass is MW divided by...
It's
by
the just, action. In this language, it's the action, which is life. And the mass of physical particles, which would never appear in the absence of the instanton monopoles, it's also exponentially small.
The action
is exponentially large. The action is not exponential. The action is 1/lambda. But the contribution of the monopoles into physical quantities is exponentially. It's e to the power minus 1/lambda. Okay?
No, but this was always this way. 1/lambda did not contradict.
I agree enthusiastically.
Okay, I will ask later.
Okay, yeah, let's discuss. Yeah.
More questions.
First a suggestion and a question.
Yes,
spoke about some alternative order parameter which can distinguish between confinement and deconfinement. There is a non-local order parameter related to entanglement entropy, which is also known in ADS, Ruta-Kayanagi formula, and you can, in principle, try to calculate it. It counts sort of degrees of freedom in the system and should be n squared in the weak coupling regime and order of one where you have confinement.
Just a very quick comment. This sounds very interesting, but entanglement entropy is ridiculously hard to compute even in perturbation theory, let alone non-perturbatively.
Well,
in quantum field theory. In ADS, it's much easier. You just could find some minimal surface. But no, that's a very interesting idea. Yes.
Okay, and the question is, when you take the string tension and global mass and continue to large L, is it parametrically also scales to some finite value, or?
Well, depends on what you mean. With my computation, I certainly cannot show that, because my computation is valid when the circle is small.
Yeah.
Lattice computations indicate that that the large volume theory has finite global masses and finite string tensions. So, and my order parameters all match, so the natural expectation is that things indeed go smoothly between the two. But I am in no position to show such a thing with the techniques that I have.
But at least at small L, do they scale in a similar way?
Yeah. That's right. Mm. Yes, that much is true. Yes.
Okay.
Okay, if there's nothing else, let's thank Alexei again. We'll be back at 2:00, so lunch is in the patio.